Whatever.
Mr. Co-Chair, are you about ready?
Do you have any family?
Yeah, I'm good.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Capital Construction to order today. Thank you all for being here. We're having an informational meeting on a report from the Cost Containment Work Group and a report from a Public Safety Work Group. And I know that we have a couple opening statements and about what we're doing here. I'm going to turn to Speaker Kotek for a couple of comments and then to Richard Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, colleagues. Good afternoon, those who are watching today's hearing. I just wanted to make a couple brief opening comments. Back in February, the Senate President and I came together to figure out how we would bring up some very important topics as related to the long-term sustainability of the state budget. And we have tasked a variety of legislators, both chambers, both parties, to help us develop ideas to help work on our budget. Our goal in setting up those work groups was to bring smart legislators together to work together side by side to develop ideas. And what you have today, and we're particularly focusing today on a couple work groups who are looking at ways to help us solve long-term structural issues within our state budget. And we will hear from two groups today. One will start off with longer range cost containment suggestions. I want to be very clear that these aren't products that have been, you know, agreed upon or negotiated in the term that we would normally look at these work groups. You know, we often do things in this building where people negotiate things and say, we are, you know, this is exactly how things should be. This is a different approach. This is saying, let's get all the best ideas on the table from as many people as possible to get a conversation started. So that's what you're going to see today. And then second, we're going to be hearing from a former state legislator, our good friend Lane Shetterly, who has been co-facilitating a work group on public safety to look at savings to help us avoid having to open up new beds for women in this state because we are over subscribed at Coffee Creek. So that'll be the second part of that. And in the coming weeks, we hope to see more discussions started from other work groups related to revenue. And hopefully we'll get those teed up soon as well. And that's what I wanted to say. Senator
Courtney, do you wish to make a couple comments?
Thank you, Chair Hovey and Speaker Kotek. As I've described it, the legislature is moving on six fronts. And in my experience, since I've been here, which is more than a few days, no legislature has ever attempted what this legislature is attempting to do. And they're also attempting it at a time when the country and the state and our way of life is very much under siege. The divisions, hatred, the violence that's out there makes it very difficult on those in government, both the elected and non-elected officials, to try to find a way to deal with serious and extraordinary differences. When the Speaker and I started to talk about how to handle the magnitude of the six fronts, we decided to continue to have faith in the process that makes Oregon legislature maybe one of the greatest legislatures in the nation, and that is to defer to what we call the committee structure, quasi-committee structure. So we asked men and women, Democrats and Republicans, who represent all the different parts of Oregon, rural and urban, if they would be willing to take on not only their existing caseloads, their existing committee structure work, and I mean their committee structure works, which means you work on a lot of committees and you work all day. That's how our system works. Now, in addition to those workloads, they were willing to come back at night after 5 o'clock And in what we're about to hear, they've spent eight or more meetings after 5 o'clock since March to see if they couldn't find ways to deal with and promote and to bring us to conclusion, Democrats, Republicans, House and Senate, on different parts of the six fronts. This is also true of the transportation plan, which was started months ago using this same approach. And today is the time in which, shall we say, one of those first work groups, quasi, is coming before this official committee, which is the Capital Construction Subcommittee Ways and Means, to present. Now, I'm just going to say this because my phone has lit up. Other people's phones have lit up because what they're about to present is already online. And I'm going to tell you, when men and women, Democrats and Republicans, are willing to take on these impossible missions, that is, in my opinion, that is what leadership looks like, sounds like, and is. I think the speaker said it right. These individuals that are about to testify here, they've been through a lot. They're going to go through more. But I think I'm just going to thank them. Peter Michael Cormac Courtney is going to officially thank them. And this state and its legislative branch and the people who are part of our state should thank them as well for being willing to take on these extraordinarily difficult tasks, near impossible. So I wish it wasn't so. I wish it was easier. I wish we were not living in the times we are, but we are. And we have gone to the best of the best to ask us to step up and to go forward. There are 90 legislators. I've often said everybody wants to be in the room until they don't. But unfortunately, there's some secretly that when they go in the room, they're not leaving until they get the job done. And they're willing to go into the room knowing full well that they can't leave the room until it's done, and knowing full well that probably all they're going to do is make not a lot of friends. But if they don't do it, this institution will fail, and we're not going to be able to do what we've got to do, what we volunteered to do, because no one's here who didn't volunteer to be here. I mean, it's just the way it is. And I'm just grateful that these individuals that are about to testify are willing to take on what we asked them to do. They've worked, they've killed themselves. I don't know how they've done it. I don't know how they've stayed here after 5, night after night, already exhausted from their everyday work to do this. So thank you, Madam Speaker. Thank you, Chair Holby, for that. But most of all, thank you, Representative Smith, Representative Nathanson, Senator Winters, Senator Devlin, Senator Johnson.
Thank you for those comments, and I think we'll move right into this conversation and have Senator Devlin up and his accompaniment.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holby and Co-Chair Girard. Senator Richard Devlin, for the record, our work group is here to present to you. They've already been introduced, but it's part of my script to actually introduce them again. So I'm going to do that. In addition to myself, my other co-chair of the Joint Ways and Means Committee, Representative Nathanson, three of the four vice chairs of the Joint Ways and Means Committee, Senators Johnson, Winters, and Greg Smith. Representative Rayfield has a lot of other assignments, so he is actually fortunate enough not to be on this work group also. Between those senators and representatives, it actually represents about three quarters of a century on ways and means in this building. Also in providing great assistance to this work group was the Legislative Fiscal Officer Ken Rocco, the Deputy Legislative Fiscal Officer Paul Siebert, Senior Analyst and probably a stalwart of state government Teresa McHugh, and many other the LFO analysts, along with from the Speaker's Office Tim Inman, and from the President's Office Betsy Imholt. It's already been indicated how many times we met. We knew we were here for very serious business, and we pursued that activity, trying to get to resolution on a number of issues we thought we should be addressing in this particular session and in the future. I have a short introductory statement, and there's been so much debate about the content of this statement that I'm going to stay pretty much on target on the statement. When we get to some of the aspects, we've asked some of the members presenting to elaborate a little bit, because some of the jargon that we use may not be as understandable to everyone and to the public at large. As we all know, Oregon is facing a $1.6 billion budget deficit for the 2017-19 biennium. This shortfall is the result of both short-term and long-term factors. In the short term, the cost of expanding health care accounts for most of the shortfall, while voter-enacted measures and pension costs each account for about one-fifth of the shortfall. But underlying the current deficit is a long-term structural imbalance between existing revenue streams and the growing cost of providing programs and services to Oregonians. The structural imbalance is due to choices legislatures have made and also voters have made in this state. Without action to contain the growing costs of state government now, the structural imbalance will cause even greater deficits in future years. We propose the following list of actions to curb future growth in the budget, make our state government more efficient, and stabilize investments in critical public services. We believe cost containment efforts are a key step toward making sustainable, long-term investments in schools, services, and programs in which Oregonians rely. The following actions are divided into two categories: temporary actions to address the 2017-19 biennium, and permanent, let me underline that, permanent ongoing actions to curb long-term growth. I will now turn it over to Senator Winters and Representative Smith.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. For the record, I still think I'm testifying. This is Jackie Winters, co-chair Gerard and co-chair Hovey. Some of the temporary, and I want to say temporary, action that we addressed for the 2017-2019 biennium, and you've already heard hiring freeze of non-essential positions. I want to emphasize that we're proposing hiring freeze for the biennium. So that would be 2017 to 2019. Just to give some context so that it's understood, that when we say non-essentials, we're talking about those 24/7 operations such as DOC, the Oregon Youth Authority, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon State Hospital, and some of DHS's personnel. Those personnels that are required to keep safety and health in our society, and who are required to do 24/7. One of the other temporary measures is that we do not, and I want to emphasize that we do not automatically grant the standard inflationary increases for services and supply cost. On those are the two temporary measures that we believe that will assist us going forward. In addition, going to the permit actions to curb long-term growth, limiting state government full-time equivalent positions to 1% of the population instead of our current practice, which is limited to 1.5% of the population. Additionally, we believe that we should ensure periodic review of position vacancies for savings and for position elimination. We all got together and drew straws as to what we were going to present to you today, and so for me now, I will turn over to the good representative, Greg Smith.
Mr. Chair, if yes. We have questions, do you want them now or do you want them later?
I prefer to get through the panel, I think, okay. and then have questions, if that's acceptable, unless people want. I mean, it's up to the panel. How would you like to answer questions?
Mr. Co-Chair, you're the co-chair of the committee. It's your decision.
Yeah. So, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Smith.
We got a lot of co-chairs in this room.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and Senator Gerard, Co-Chair, Madam Speaker, Senate President. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57 in Eastern Oregon, Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and Representative Huffman, the very, very best parts of Wasco County. It's great to be with you today. I'm in my ninth term in the Oregon Legislature. For the most part, that's all serving on Ways and Means. And I currently serve as the House Republican Budget Chair. I'm pleased to be here today and to be part of this conversation. Following the good senator, this group of representatives and senators came up with a few additional permanent ongoing actions to curb long-term growth in our state budget. One of those includes requiring legislative review of state agency debt collection performance and approval of agency write-off of debt. Right now, your Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government is undertaking this conversation. The good representative from the Central Oregon Coast is leading this conversation, and I anticipate in the coming weeks we're going to have additional ideas for you to consider on this. But we believe that there's additional savings to be had by reviewing our debt collection practices. An additional item is reviewing the Lottery Commission's administrative costs and the transfer rate to determine if more funds could be transferred for public purposes. As background, I'd share with you legislative fiscal shared with our committee that voters passed two ballot measures in 1984 that established a state lottery and the State Lottery Commission. One was a constitutional amendment, and another was implementing statutory language. Currently, the legislature does not approve the State Lottery Commission budget. It does not set State Lottery Commission expenditures in the budget and does not limit the number of employees the commission hires. We believe that this is something that needs to be reviewed. Legislative Council has shared with us that there's an opportunity for us to perhaps review this and bring concepts forward that would allow for additional dollars to be put into other uses. An additional idea that we would like to bring forward for consideration is reducing bonding costs, including paying for small projects with cash rather than borrowing, and looking at increasing the overall cost or reducing the overall cost of long-term debt. Let me just share with you very briefly, colleagues, and again, this is language provided by legislative fiscal to us. The 2017 Commission report from the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission identifies target debt capacity limits for the general fund to remain at or below 5% of the general fund, and lottery fund debt service remain at or below 25% of net unobligated lottery revenues. Currently, as of July 1st, 2017, we'll be at approximately 3.9% of general fund and 22% of net unobligated lottery revenues. And so based on that information, again, we've thought it was worthwhile for us to consider, rather than borrowing money on smaller projects, to actually cash fund those directly. And we thought $3 million was a good threshold. Second, we believe that we need to have additional conversation on deferred maintenance of capital improvement projects that we finance collectively. And third, we believe that as a method of preventing the accumulation of deferred maintenance, the legislature should establish a biennial target for actually funding deferred maintenance. Now, this might add additional expense on the front end, but we believe is a long-term approach to bending down the cost curve in our state budget, taking care of that deferred maintenance now, not letting it accumulate and having to take care of much larger problems in the future. In addition to that, we had two additional permanent ongoing actions to curb long-term growth. One is to look at reducing expenditures that just simply aren't needed any longer. And I would share with you that there's many good ideas out there. I think citizens around the state of Oregon, interest groups around the state of Oregon, will be sharing with us many ways in which we might be able to just eliminate those functions that just simply don't need to occur any longer. And Madam Speaker, Mr. President, I think it's at one point in time we'll be asking you to have an additional conversation, perhaps to have a work group around that concept. And then finally, colleagues, we believe that there ought to be additional vigor in the vending contract process. Those folks who owe the state of Oregon money, perhaps they should be paying their debt back to the state of Oregon prior to entering into contractual agreements with the state. And those folks, we think there just needs to be additional vigor in how that process works out. I know Senator Johnson, who will be joining us here momentarily, has thoughts on that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think I'll turn for some questions.
Do you want to add questions for this panel?
Yes.
Okay.
Question.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this was to Senator Winters. I wanted to make sure I understood that. Is there an official definition of essential and non-essential positions? And if so, who decides?
I'd like the staff to come up, but I do believe that there is.
Okay.
We've always viewed the essential as those personnel, such as our guards that are part of the public safety community, correctional officers.
Yes.
Correctional officers, the Oregon Youth Authority, and those officers who work with the authority at the Oregon State Hospital, the personnel who are required 24/7 to be there. So I believe that there is a definitive definition of those who are considered essential.
Yeah, I'd be interested in getting that if we could. I'm concerned about caseworkers and home health care workers and those types of service providers and whether they fall where the line is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Speaker Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Smith, and this is your comments about the lottery. I just want to throw another idea out there. I was meeting with the lottery director the other day, and we brought up the conversation of sports action. As many of you know, we were prohibited. The legislature took action years ago to stop the sports action lottery because of concerns from the NCAA about certain types of sports betting. In my conversations with him just the other day, this idea that the landscape of sports gambling has changed nationwide, and perhaps as one of the only states that could be grandfathered in to do sports action again, we should, I think, look at petitioning the NCAA about whether or not we bring that back, because we are currently trying to maintain a commitment to collegiate sports based on the fact that we eliminated that funding stream a few years ago. So I just want to put that out there to add to the lottery bucket.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I'd actually share with you just this week, two of Heppner's finest students who attend Eastern Oregon University testified before, I believe, is the House Education Committee on sports lottery action and the scholarships that are created from that. And so I think that's a conversation worth following up on.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Actually, may I?
Yes.
Thank you.
Go right ahead.
Sorry, Representative Smith. You mentioned eliminating current expenditures that are no longer needed. Is that a list that's forthcoming? Because that wasn't part of this work group.
That's one of those items we put on because we just thought it made sense for us to actually take a look at. Are there services, are there functions that just are simply obsolete? And to ask your Ways and Means Committee perhaps to create a small little subcommittee that just works with LFO and the public for that matter to just get ideas is, are there services out there that while at one point in time were a great idea, simply are no longer needed? And is there a way to take those dollars and put them into other purposes?
Thank you. And I do think we want to explore that. I just know, having been on a couple...
It's a difficult conversation.
Well, just, you know, given the cuts we made during the recession and other things, I'd be curious to know what that list might look like at this point. But
let me give you an example. And this is the silliest of examples, but it is an example. Years ago, this legislature required studying of the Great Potato Famine the Irish potato famine, and it required school districts to teach that. And as a consequence, it required folks to spend time in that effort. While that's just a microcosm of an example, and we appreciate it being from the Irish capital of Oregon, it's probably one of those areas that no longer needs to continue. Are there other services or functions that at one time was a good idea, but today we could do it?
Thank you.
Thank you, and I think I'll finish with, I have one question back to Senator Winters on back to the freeze on the hiring of non-essential positions. I know that we oftentimes will budget for so many positions, some of them are held vacant in anticipation of changes perhaps in caseload. I'll use unemployment for an example. When the economy starts dipping, we have an increased demand for positions to handle unemployment insurance claims. Would this freeze somehow anticipate or have some flexibility in it to address those demands when caseloads would change?
I believe yes. I mean, you know, we always have in this body, as you know, even when we take an action like this, you know, our one ability in budgets actually is between, and I pointed to the co-chair because he also has, we have the emergency board. So when there is an emergency that arises, as you pointed out, I think there are still those abilities. It does not take away the, you know, what we know about freezing personnel action or freezing salaries. In addition, this session, we are looking at, quote, caseloads, quote unquote, because as you know, we have caseload models, and given the climate that we are today, and I know the good co-chair, Senator Devlin, the other co-chair, were not holding to those loads that we had actually put together several years ago because the economy has changed and the need has changed.
Yes. Mr. Chair, can I ask one final question? If staff is going to be able to find the definition of non-essential, I'd be interested in how many positions would be impacted and what that means cost savings-wise.
I believe, just to follow up, the staff is working on that as we speak and as we talk, and they will be getting back with a more definitive of who they are and then how much of savings that we would realize.
Thank you.
Did you have
something? Well, I was going to share, Mr. Co-Chair, adding to Senator Winter's comments, while it's natural for us to think of public safety as essential, in addition to that, we need to keep in mind that there are state positions that actually help generate revenue for the state of Oregon. And for example, in the Oregon Department of Revenue right now, there's about 130 vacant positions, and it'd be very easy for us to just grab and take those dollars. But the reality is many of those positions help generate the dollars we need to function as a state. And so I think that's a conversation where we'll need to be careful on how we define non-essential.
Thank you. Representative Huffman now.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senator Winters, did LFO generate a report on how many vacant positions there are amongst all the agencies? I know back in 2010, I saw a report. There was a little over 4,000 total vacancies. In the 2011 session, we took back about 550. Do we know what the number stands at today?
I'm going to turn this over to the Senator Devlin, but as you know, each subcommittee, budget subcommittee, is actually looking at vacancies for this biennium. So, but I'll let him respond to the broader question.
I think Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, I think the senator gave a very good answer. We don't have an absolute number on that right now. Obviously, it's a snapshot in time, any time that you do it. But routinely, as we look through budgets, we are actually making that examination and determining whether those positions need to be retained, those position authority needs to be retained or not. That's a normal part of the process. This actually gives me an opportunity to say something very quickly. Some of the items that you don't see on this list are the items that we will normally do, and we actually will try to do all these too, but there are a lot of items that we normally do in the budget process. I mean, we are supposed to be looking for functions that are no longer providing significant services to the state that are needed and potentially eliminating those. We're supposed to be looking for positions that are no longer necessary in agencies. We're actually, part of it is looking for savings in every budget that we have, and also at the same time as we're looking for savings, looking at needs that need to be addressed within those agencies, some things that are not going as well as we would have hoped they'd go, and see if that answer is in doing something a little bit differently, or if in some cases actually additional resources are needed to meet a need that is out there.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. In 2010, leading up to the 2011 session, we got a letter from agency director that said they were going to balance the 9% cut that Governor Kulongoski had asked for across the board by not filling 500 vacancies within this agency. Well, I had only been around a couple of years at that point, and I'm like, why would an agency have 500 unfilled positions? That was how many that they were going to use to balance the 9% cut. I don't know how many total vacancies there were within the agency, but it got me to questioning and brought us into the 2011 session where we were able to go through the process and the budgeting process and take back 550 positions. And if you figure $80,000 to $100,000 with benefits and everything, you multiply that out and you start getting into real money when you dig into the vacancies that are true vacancies used for other purposes than waiting to fill them if the economy goes up or whatever. I happened to call it back then agency slush funds, but I was told that they really didn't like that term, and so you can tell I've stopped using that.
So. Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As someone who sat in subcommittee rooms when we were trying to manage the budgets during the recession, I do recall that conversation. It was an excellent conversation. I think people, particularly the public, should understand a lot of positions that were being held due to lack of funds were eliminated. A lot of position authority was eliminated. So I think this revisiting of that discussion on open positions, I think we're not going to have those types of level of savings, I would doubt. Perhaps we have. The other question I think we should look at is we should base this on facts of what we will save and what will we not be able to do when we don't fill positions. Often we have open positions because we don't have the right people yet in the hiring pool. But when we don't fill positions, particularly in places like child welfare, it has definitive impact. So I just want to make sure people understand that these have real consequences, even though they look like just plain old numbers on a sheet somewhere.
Well, not being totally new to this conversation, but a little bit, can you elaborate on these vacant positions a little bit more for me specifically, or maybe for others? Do those vacant positions, are we actually expending money for them, or when we have vacant positions, are those dollars just remaining in the general fund, or are they actually being distributed?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it would be probably better to give to a formal response from the legislative fiscal officer, but I'll take it from the standpoint that I would take it. If they are permanent positions that have been authorized by the legislature, they are part of the current service level budget. And most people don't realize this, but we have very detailed budgets for state agencies, but we only appropriate on a limited number of lines for each agency, meaning they do have discretion. We obviously watch to see if they are following the budgets that they have. But they do actually have the funding for those positions in their budgets. Now, there are some cases in which there are some issues within agencies where there's issues of vacant positions being held open for the wrong reason. to be able to do other things. However, there are some agencies where there are significant issues about turnover in positions, where it is quite common to have large numbers of positions open. I'll cite two that are a little bit different from one another. We all know how few actual state troopers we actually have on the ground. So as we've gone through transitions there, and the state trooper force looks much more like Representative Williamson than it looks like me, there isn't as much turnover there as there was 10 or 15 years ago. But we have well over 4,000 people in our corrections, Department of Corrections, well over 10,000, many of them in custody positions, and it's probably not uncommon to have a number of people there. We also recognize that in some of our positions, and some of the public safety positions are clearly like this, but some positions that are not public safety, like some of the frontline workers within human services, particularly those who work in child welfare, there's always going to be some turnover there because of burnout, but there's also going to be turnover there because people get into those positions thinking that they are something that they would really want to do, and they're very sincere in that. And when they realize the realities of the work that they have to do, some of them don't last too many years. They're almost, in a sense, like our school teachers, a very large number of people that actually go out and get master's degrees to become public school teachers do not last longer than 5 years once they get into the classroom because they realize the issues that they face. So it is normal in some entities to have quite a bit of turnover, and dependent upon the size of the entity, you can have quite a number of vacant positions. But there has occasionally been issues where you could actually state that there has been some misuse of state of vacant positions within agencies.
You know, Mr. Chair, I'd add to that conversation, there's a third leg to that stool in that we have a handful of agencies that actually serve as a training ground for the private sector. What comes to mind is both the Department of Justice and the Department of Revenue, where folks come out of law school, come out of business school, come to work for the state of Oregon for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then they're off to private practice. And it makes it very difficult for those professional agencies to retain their personnel after they've received a few years of training.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that just brings up, I would assume, when we're all, well into this exercise, that we would be looking potentially at the revenue impacts that reducing these services might cause to the state and to the private sector. So we really have a full view of what we're doing. But I want to move on. Thank you so much for starting us off. Senator Johnson. And I think Representative Nathanson is up right after that.
And Mr. Chair, well, if I may, since people are changing seats, I might add to the list for the staff who are listening. Can we look at the cost of turnover? Because every time, some agencies, if their turnover is particularly high, we are spending more money for overtime as well as additional training costs. So I just want to throw that out for the ether for conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, colleagues. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I serve Senate District 16. As we move into more specific subject areas that may undoubtedly generate questions and possibly controversy, I want to emphasize several points. First of all, these are conceptual. They haven't been fully priced, i.e., vetted completely for savings. There are other proposals currently under discussion in a variety of venues, including policy committees. At this point, no decisions have been made, so these should be considered a starting point for discussion and subject to further refinement, analysis, and negotiation. So let me start with take steps to reduce PERS costs. Increase current and future employees' share in retirement costs for all public employees who are members of PERS. Require all PERS employers to set aside excess operating funds for the prepayment of future employer costs, typically referred to as side accounts. Determine whether the amortization period is set for the appropriate length of time. And this would include impacts of changing from the current 20 years to a longer amortization period and the effect on short-term rates versus the negative effect on the UAL. Ensure that the PERS administrative reserves are at an appropriate level and use any excess administrative reserves to reduce the unfunded liability. We need to continue to improve the management of and contain health care costs for public employees. The proposal that we have worked on would combine the Public Employee Benefit Board, typically referred to as PEB, with the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, OEB. Then require the combined PEB and OEB to stay within a 3.4% annual growth rate. And tie PEB and OEB non-primary care rates to a percentage of Medicare rates. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I will do the next section. For the record, one thing I would like to state is there was a lot of discussion in this particular section and one of the most difficult sections to come to agreement on. But the real purpose here is to create certainty or more certainty in a world in which we actually have less and less certainty in the budget process in terms of being able to plan. Having more certainty is something that you really actually strive for. And one of the things that we are looking for here, it is not an issue about collective bargaining in the sense that I think many of us on the working group spoke out strongly in favor of collective bargaining rights of employees. We just want to be able to predict what those liabilities are on a more consistent basis. So in that light, we want to ensure that compensation increases are within the budget for the biennium in which they are granted and do not exceed normal growth rates for future biennium. We need to manage the timing of cost of living increases to restrain future roll-up costs. While this always cannot be done, there is an issue in terms of when you put together a package if some of the increases occur very late in the biennium. If they occur very late in the biennium, the roll-up on those costs can be substantial in future biennium because you're only paying for a few months in one biennium and then you have to pay for 24 months in the following. Also, any cost of living increases for employees of organizations reliant on state general fund should follow the same rules as increases for state employees. That's actual in-house jargon for saying those entities that are very dependent upon state funding for their operations should adopt some of these principles also. Those are entities like school districts. Those are entities like our universities and community colleges. And to some extent, those are entities of counties where we contract for services with the counties to perform various state functions. We should limit the economic issues in collective bargaining agreements with the state for 2 years. That's so that we actually do not get agreements that actually commit future legislatures to levels of funding. Next, we should change the collecting bargaining process to even-numbered years, so the governor's budget proposal includes the full cost of increases for the upcoming biennium. This is something that we would need to transition into. The current process right now, which most of you are familiar with, is we set a certain amount of money in the budget aside for collective bargaining agreements. Those collective bargaining agreements sometimes are actually reached before we actually leave this building. Many times in the past and in recent times have been settled after. So we find the actual cost of those collective bargaining agreements after we have actually left the building. We would have to actually give some indication to the executive branch of the range in this. But in this particular scenario, if we were able to do this, we would arrive in this building to do the next biennial budget, knowing what the cost would be for the various collective bargaining agreements. And for clarification here, just for all the members here to understand this, but whatever we reach normally in these collective bargaining agreements are the same increases that pretty standardly, though it does not have to be that way, that those state employees who are not in collective bargaining agreements reach, so or receive. Second, the final item are two items. One is to require legislative approval for the following before they can be implemented. These are the two items. They're both a little bit controversial, but I should explain both of them in a little bit of detail. To require legislative approval for reclassifications of positions. Now, some of you may envision that we're going to have a special committee out there that is going to individually approve every reclassification. That isn't the idea. The idea is basically we take actions normally even when we're not in session on a relatively quarterly basis. It would be that actually on a quarterly basis, with this is one way this could be done, the LFO would receive reports of classifications. They would review them. they would bring ones to us and probably say, these 110 are approved, these 10 are questionable and should not be approved. And so in the interim, an e-board could make that decision. Not in an interim, it would obviously be the full legislature, but it would not be actually individually approving each reclassification. The next thing happens very rarely, but when it does happen, it can have significant impacts long-term in the compensation costs within budgets. And that is when you are in collective bargaining that you add a step in all classifications across the board. When you do that, when you add a step and you like take away the bottom step, you have added approximately about, in our case, about 4.3% to that position. That may only impact about 40% of the workforce at that time who are already at the top step. But long term, that will have a much more significant impact. This is not so much an issue of what is the appropriate compensation for the employee. It is an issue of being able to predict what the costs will be. And so that when we sort of predict that, we say that this is going to be our cost for steps, this is going to be our stop cost for COLA. When you do this in collective bargaining and do across the board without legislative direction to do that, you then can put in place significant costs within the budget without any pre sort of discussion with the legislature in terms of taking that action. And also that there have been a few occasions, one recently where we believe this occurred, and we'll verify that, in just one agency, but it's had ripple impacts actually throughout some of the agencies and some of the issues within those agencies. An aside here is just the co-chair of Ways and Means, the Senate co-chair of Ways and Means. There is something here that is not in here that I think is, some people have used this opportunity to be extemporating us, so I'm going to use that opportunity also. The other thing that you get into long term is that we should have a compensation path, a compensation process where we determine clearly what the appropriate compensation of individuals are. This state has not done a broad compensation and classification study long before I came to the legislature. They've done it piecemeal. It is expensive to do. We are losing the ability to basically say what is the appropriate level of funding. We have people in state government that are, in some cases, probably significantly underpaid. We may have some that are overpaid. We have some responsibilities to individuals to pay them appropriate amounts, even when sometimes positions that some people would classify as lower positions are paid for significantly less in the private sector when there is a judgment by this body that people should be treated more equitably and people have the right to something that is a family wage position, even if in that position in the private sector it is being paid significantly less. That's not the issue. But we have not had any really broad classification and compensation study in this state, I think, since the mid-1980s. And it is about time we actually came to the table and put the dollars forward to be able to do that. That's just a personal commentary, not part of the group. With that, I will go to the most, what I believe, and what Representative Mason, my co-chair, believe, the material that excites us. Excites us.
Yeah, as being, as you indicated to me, having the gavel, I'd like to preempt your panel and go to questions for you and Senator Johnson before we hear from Representative Nathanson. So, because I know people are just kind of dying to get some questions out on these topics. Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To add to my list of information that I would like, I'm interested on the PEB and OEB staying under the 3.4%. Have we gone over that since the cap was instituted?
Betsy Johnson, for the record, yes. It depends how the number's calculated, and I think that's one of the problems, is that various entities have come up with different calculations, but having sat in on one of the last PEB board meetings, the answer would be yes.
And then my follow-up to that is, it seems like these proposals, I'd be interested to know with the healthcare proposals how this prices out versus moving all employees into CCOs.
Go ahead.
If, with the chair's indulgence, I'm going to say some things that will probably get me in trouble.
I just know that we've got a couple of proposals floating around. Interested to hear
and
how
maybe,
they compare.
Maybe
you're more than welcome to go get put yourself in trouble. I'm
okay.
quite all right with
or
me.
Or I can take my answer later if you don't want to get yourself in trouble, Senator.
Okay, but I'll just say it relatively quickly. We have approximately 1 million people in the Oregon Health Plan. Many of them, though not all of them, are in CCO. Some of them are still fee-for-service. We have approximately 300,000 lives between OEB and PEB. The requirements in each area are vastly different. The integration of those two would be relatively difficult to do. Our CCOs have only been in existence in a few years, and there are issues within our CCOs that need to be resolved. The underlying assumption of this is that Medicaid is cheap. When you hear about this discussion, Medicaid is not cheap. The numbers are not small. The other issue that's out there relative to this is that I probably shouldn't have tried to answer this question, but to even attempt to do this would probably take several years of underlying work that would be necessary to determine how you would do it, because you would be integrating what is Medicaid programs with non-Medicaid programs. And the underlying assumption, and I'm going to return to that, that's getting myself in a little trouble here, is that this is inexpensive. If I could actually have time or had LFO time to show you what the underlying costs of Medicaid are, they are not inexpensive. And the idea that there could be some automatic savings, and then you get to the issue of who are we insuring? And we also know when we look at the Medicaid rates and we look at the different populations within Medicaid rates, I'm actually, in a sense, I'm not average by any sense, probably I'm older than average in that pool, but the people insured in PEB are on average older. And so the rates are going to be higher for those, even if you put them into a CCO under Medicaid. They would compare like the rates within those and their factors in terms of people that are of that age. There are just 100 issues that would need to be addressed before you could even attempt to do this. And I think people should rely upon back-of-the-napkin estimates of what the savings would be. I'll put it at that.
I might just add, if I may, that the notion of combining PEB and OEB will have sufficient complexities in and of itself. They offer different benefits. However, I have approached this question from the perspective that to have two separate parallel universes operating, both using different actuaries, at one point both having different boards, both having different back rooms. They now have a combined executive director given the departure of the last OEB. That will be fraught with sufficient complexities for the purpose of this exercise.
Thank you.
Other questions? Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like since we're moving on to the budget principles, I just want to reiterate for all those who are listening the opening statements about these things not being priced. And that's okay at this point in the game, but they will get priced because we want to be led by facts and what makes good policy sense and what we're actually saving in the long run and in the short term. One of the things that I do know, just since it's Representative Smith's bill and mine, the third bullet under PEP, tying PEB and OEB non-primary care rates to a percentage of Medicare, that will save substantial money in the tens of millions of dollars by puts in price controls on the things we purchase through those insurance programs. So, but I just want to remind people we have a lot of work to do yet to actually know what these things will save or not save in the long run. So,
Madam Speaker, I think you get no objection from any of us that have been doing this work.
I bet. Thank you, Senator.
And I think I have just one last question, I think, for Senator Devlin, who kind of touched on this topic just a little bit, talking about, our workforce at state government primarily, but, I suppose public service as well. When we're talking about, reduction in benefits or reduction in compensation and those sorts of, trying to contain those costs, Have we really, or will we dive into an analysis of what that does to the workforce? What kind of, will we see a sort of a mass exodus in retirement? Because we have, you know, a lot of people that are probably eligible to retire. And then on the flip side of that, what's that going to do to our ability to recruit? And I say that as, and I'll give you an example that we're faced with very shortly. We have a chief administrative law judge, which is probably going to be retiring, and we will be in going for a search for a new one. And I was involved in reviewing those last time, and it took an incredibly long time to find a replacement because the salary was so low that even just staff attorneys wouldn't take the job. And, you know, that we have some inequities across state government, and we have to weigh that with what's out and available in the private sector. And so I think, I don't know if DAS from Human Resources is the right input to that element, but I think it's something we have to consider in looking at the and a lot of these actions.
Mr. Chairman, would you like a comment?
Yes, sure.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're taking all those into consideration, and I do know from some of the discussions in some of our other committees, they are taking that into consideration. Clearly, I believe, and I believe the people of the work group, believe that public employees should be compensated justly. They should not be underpaid. They should have packages that are commensurate with what they would receive if they were not public employees. And I think that's part of this, the discussion that we're having. There are some areas where there are some concerns that sort of loose discussions could lead to an exodus. And I know that one of our committees in the Senate has been working around PERS-related issues. And some of us that understand some of the numbers there know that we have still within public employment, not just state employment, about 35,000 Tier 1 members in public employment in the state, 20,000 of which, approximately 20,000 of which, could retire tomorrow. And that is of concern because losing that many people from the workforce because there is, they are reacting to just sort of loosely put out options is kind of problematic. I know that you have probably answered a few of those emails. I have answered a few of those emails. And I do think we have to be careful what we say because it can have ramifications out there in the people that are very vital to us providing services to Oregonians.
Thank you for that comment. I knew you could say it better than I. Now we'll turn to Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. Thank you to my budget co-chair for saying that this work is exciting. I actually like this policy wonk stuff. I'm going to propose to you now.
So why? I won't call you weird.
To now propose to you cost containment budget principles that we believe are important. Do not create programs and start them at the end of the biennium, which only obscures the real biennial cost a full 2 years, because in the budget that's being adopted at the moment, the cost is only a few months. Do not create new programs or funds that have no money to support them. Use one-time funds for one-time investments or save them for an emergency. Do not automatically replace lost federal or other funding. And please note that I said do not automatically. We recognize that there are circumstances under which we would want to replace, or sometimes that's called backfill, with some sort of other funds, general fund or another funding source. But we're saying that as a principle, we should not automatically always do that. Require analysis of ongoing costs rather than only initial costs for all new programs. Review performance and need for current programs and services to determine whether new proposals are a higher priority than current programs and services. And this is not placing a value or presupposing an outcome on the new versus the existing, but it's saying we need to compare them. Transition the timing of issuing bonds to reduce future roll-up costs. Prioritize preservation and maintenance of infrastructure before constructing new buildings. And finally, limit creating new task forces, boards, and commissions. I want to conclude on a more personal note. First, thank you for the questions and comments that you've already provided this afternoon. We will be digging deeper into each of these ideas to discern which ones, how they could be or would be implemented, and what it would take to do it. And we'll be putting a number, an estimate, on what the cost savings would be. I have thought about this a lot over the past weeks that we've been meeting, and even before we started meeting. And last night I worked on some notes. They're reflections on the work that's in front of us, not only those of us on this work group, but for all of us as a legislature. We're here because we want what's best for Oregon. And as we all know, we are facing a serious budget shortfall this biennium, a shortfall that challenges our ability to meet the basic needs of our state, and a shortfall that will only become harder to manage in the future unless we take action this session. Still, it's not easy to sit before this committee and present these ideas. Any reductions to state employees, while necessary given our budget challenges, will be on the backs of middle and low-income Oregonians. These are the hardworking people who teach our kids, take care of our seniors, and keep our communities safe. Nonetheless, it's clear that taking action this session will require statesmanship and compromise. I believe that is exactly what you have seen here today. For months now, we have worked together, Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate, to come up with ideas that move us closer to seizing this opportunity to set our state on a path to a more stable future. Today's conversation is an important first step. I've been clear, as many of us have, that solving our structural budget problems will require targeted cuts, permanent cost containment strategies, and revenue reform. Ultimately, we want to stabilize our budget so we can finally make investments in Oregonians' chosen priorities: high-quality schools, affordable health care, and a strong, equitable economy that gives all Oregonians an opportunity to thrive. I'm hopeful that today we are setting an example that will help us continue an honest, bipartisan effort to meet those goals for all the Oregonians we serve. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any final?
I've got some thoughts I'd like to share, Mr. Chair.
Representative Williamson.
I want to start by thanking the committee for doing this difficult work, looking at long-term and short-term. Budget shortfalls is not fun, and these were really difficult conversations, I know. I am interested, and anybody who has served on a Ways and Means Committee with me knows that I am a data-driven budget person. I want to make sure that what we're doing has the impact we think it's going to have, and we're not working off of assumptions and back of the napkin calculations, which sometimes we can do. And I'm not only interested in what the savings are to the state for these kinds of policy choices that are in front of us, but what is the cost to Oregon families? All three of the areas of funding that we look at are savings, retirement, health care, and compensation, all come from employees. So at some point, I want to know what are these three, if we implement health care, compensation, retirement reforms like these, what does that mean to an average state worker? We know that right now we're at about 98% of market value for the employees that we have in this state. as far as their total compensation, and what does that do to our competitiveness, our ability to recruit, if we drop well below a total compensation package that keeps us competitive with the private sector. And as the senator noted, what happens when people start retiring? Because they know we're having these compensation conversations, retirement conversations. They're at retirement. They know we're going to do something, and we're under a hiring freeze. That concerns me greatly because of the ability for our state workers to deliver services that Oregonians rely on. We need them there to do that. You know, I know that we are trying to serve, we're trying to save money and solve long-term problems, and I just don't, I know we're having larger conversations, but I want to make sure that we are consistently thinking about who is going to pay for these long-term solutions. And these proposals, our state employees are paying for them, and I think that state employees have continued time after time to come to the table, whether it's foregoing raises and hiring freezes and the like, in order to help us save money in the budget and meet our financial obligations, particularly in downturns of the economy. But I want to make sure we're really cognizant in this conversation about the people that we're impacting. And frankly, I like I said, I worry about our competitiveness in the workforce. I also worry about the impacts of both the cuts budget and these proposals on our economies, and what happens when you're in a community where a large employer is a school or a university or a hospital, and the state is a primary employer in your community. How will this impact our local, our local economies, a city like Salem that's chock-a-block with state employees, when we start making these real compensation reductions? What does that mean to a city like Salem? And finally, I just Leader McLean yesterday said that, you know, he wanted to engage in a process by which we first look at growing the economy. And whether, you know, I adopt his philosophy and how we should be negotiating this, that's another story. But I do think that the reverse is true, which is what are the impacts of our cuts and of our of these compensation rollbacks? What impact will they have on the economy? And at what point do the decisions we make here either depress our economic growth or throw us into a recession? And I'm very concerned about that as well. And I know that we will be getting further information, but that's the kind of information that I'm looking for, is what are the economic impacts one or two steps out from our Oregon families that have to bear the cost of these, personally bear the cost of these cost savings for the state.
Other final comments? Thank you very much for all this work and this presentation. With that, we're going to move on to our next presentation, a report from the Public Safety Work Group.
Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues.
That would be Mr. Lane Shetterly.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, colleagues, we're going to hear from the Honorable former Representative Lane Shetterly. He joined another one of our colleagues, Greg McPherson, to facilitate a process to talk specifically about potential cost avoidance, cost savings, reworking of how we do business in the public safety system for the purpose of trying to bend the cost trend in that segment of our budget. And I'm really pleased that he's here to join us today to talk about that work. And I want to thank him personally, as well as former Representative Greg McPherson, for his work, who couldn't be with us today. So, Mr. Chair, it's all yours.
Thank you. First, I'd just like to acknowledge all the people involved in this work group and helping you, and you're speaking for all of them today, I assume.
Co-chair, members of the committee, I am here on behalf of the Public Safety Work Group. I think I need to set the record straight that I don't know that I could say I'm speaking for all of them. And in fact, I think in our report, one of the points I make, oh, for the record, did I say Lane Shetterly?
Thank you.
Sorry about that. I should know better. Lane Shetterly, in this case, I'm appearing before you as a very short-term chair of the Public Safety Work Group at the request of the speaker. And as she said, I did work with former Representative Greg McPherson. We both felt it was sort of like an episode of Space Cowboys to get us back together again and saddled up and with a committee like this, but it was a lot of fun. As my report indicates, we had a very engaged group. You have the report in front of you, and it is a broadly representative group of not particularly wallflower type individuals. And I have to tell you, as I acknowledge in the report, that the recommendations that we make as a committee do not represent the unanimous opinion of the members of the work group. I want to acknowledge that. Having said that, I will say that every one of the members of the work group participated in good faith and energetically. They were engaged, attended meetings, and I would say that the recommendations that do come forward at least were well informed by the opinions and viewpoints of the members of the work group, even who may not endorse the final recommendations. So thank you, Madam Speaker, for the opportunity to get involved in this. It's been a long time since I've done this kind of work, but it was a pleasure to do that, and a great committee that you created a task force for this. The charge of the task force, I think the speaker pretty well gave you that, and that was to find ways in the public safety arena, particularly around sentencing, to bend the cost curve, and looking at cost savings in public safety and sentencing reforms, you really have to look at two areas. One is immediate budget savings. The other one, which is really where the significant savings is in cost avoidance. We are at a point, and I think you know certainly better than I do, that we're close to that tipping point, particularly in our women's population at Coffee Creek, and the number of temporary beds that we are utilizing around the state to deal with the overcrowding at Coffee Creek, at a point where we are treading close to that place where we would have to make the commitment to build out a new prison for women. And clearly anything we can do to manage the population to avoid that cost, both in terms of the capital expense as well as then the ongoing investment and operational expenses, will be a great savings, not in the immediate biennium, but certainly biennia to come. And so we were cognizant of both of those, both in terms of cost savings that might be captured now, but more importantly, I think, the cost avoidance in being able to manage our population and not having to build new prison capacity. In a nutshell, and I will try to be brief, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions, we looked at several areas, and we kind of played with different scenarios. But what we came up with in terms of our recommendations are in the areas of expanding short-term transitional leave, modifying, not suspending, but modifying ballot measure 57, encouraging the expansion of what we call local Senate Bill 416 models in a statewide to more counties that are not currently using a 416 kind of model. I'd have to say Senate Bill 416 is probably the best bill that never became law in terms of the impact that it's had in creating the incentive, not an incentive, but in just creating the thinking and the opening up possibilities in counties to say we could do some of these things, even without direct statutory authorization. We were very impressed with the presentations we got on Senate Bill 416 kinds of models, and then expanding work release programs. I'll talk about those recommendations in just a second, but recognizing, and it's also in the report, that these recommendations do particularly and disproportionately address the women's prison population, because property crime proportionally affects more women than men in terms of offenders. Of those offenders, in many cases, the property crimes are tied to drug addiction, and mental health issues that really are amenable to intensive supervision that is available or can be available if we make it available. And at the same time, in the reforms that we are recommending, moving that population out of prison is what really addresses the Coffee Creek situation and the women's prison population. In terms of short-term transitional leave, we as a group are recommending that short-term transitional leave be expanded from 90 to 120 days. We saw some preliminary numbers from the Criminal Justice Commission that were very impressive in terms of the rates of recidivism among offenders who have been through the short-term transitional leave. And I say preliminary, I think they're not in a position yet, and I can't say that there has been a definitive determination of that. But certainly, again, the early numbers are very promising, which suggests to us that short-term transitional leave that helps move offenders back into the community with adequate support and supervision, it serves their interest, and it also serves the interest of public safety because we see less crime being committed by those offenders who have been through that short-term transitional leave program. We looked at further expansion to 150, 180 days. We determined that probably 120 days is the sweet spot in terms of the current ability of community corrections and other services in the community to be able to manage. Not that that will be easy, but we felt that that was probably a target that we could hit and still make short-term transitional leave work. In terms of Measure 57, we did look at suspending Measure 57, the Speaker gave us a specific goal that she wanted us to reduce the prison bed population by 880 beds by 2025. And if you suspend Measure 57, you can do that, along with these other measures that we've recommended. I think we were of the opinion probably that suspending Measure 57 was a very steep hill, and there wasn't a lot of appetite in the committee to recommend that to the legislature. However, we are recommending modifications to Measure 57 addressing identity theft and theft one, that's theft up to $1,000. In particular, you do get a significant reduction in prison beds if you back those out of ballot Measure 57. Again, those are predominantly crimes disproportionately committed by women. And so by dealing with those, we reduce the prison bed population and particularly the prison bed population of women offenders. We do encourage the expansion of local Senate Bill 416 models. As I mentioned, we are really excited to see what Marion County has done. Lane County has a version. Multnomah County has a version. There's a lot of creativity out in the counties that are doing this. And what they're doing is basically a risk-based assessment in terms of determining who might be eligible for Senate Bill 416, which is an enhanced supervision in lieu of incarceration, in lieu of prison sentence. And again, what we are hearing anecdotally is that the early returns on that are very positive in the benefit that they're having on helping to reform the offenders' lives and reduce rates of recidivism and thereby enhancing public safety. And the last thing is an expansion of our work release programs. If you look at Exhibit B on the report, It tells you what the savings are on the these pages aren't numbered, but there is a page in Exhibit B that summarizes all of the savings, sort of the all options. I think it is the first page. Yeah. No. Let me find that. Yeah, it's about three pages in from the back. If you were to go to the maximum scenario, and that would be expanding short-term transitional leave to 180 days, suspending ballot measure 57, statewide 416, and a work release program, you could reduce prison beds by 1,138. Again, we thought that while that certainly would achieve the speaker's target, we thought that was probably not a practical solution to offer. Where we came down is the sort of the lighter scenario. of expanding short-term transition leave to 120 days, addressing ID theft and theft one in ballot measure 57, removing those from the measure, and then also the statewide 416 and work release programs, and that would reduce the prison population, according to CJC's numbers, by 568. In terms of dollars savings, you have a separate memorandum from LFO that really was not generated as part of our work group. We didn't see it until our work was done, but building on the work that we did, that scenario that we recommend basically shows a cost savings, including avoided costs, of almost $20 million. So there's significant numbers there. We thought as a committee, as a majority of the committee, that those recommendations could be accomplished without doing harm to public safety, in fact, improving public safety, because we would be addressing some of the pathologies in offenders' lives that lead to the criminal behavior that gets them into the system, and would be of benefit then to our communities and also to the state budget now, but particularly over time. Madam Speaker, I think that's about all I had to say, unless there, well, I'm certainly happy to answer questions. It's been a great, let's say, I've learned a lot. Of course, when I was on the Judiciary Committee here in the legislature, I spent quite a bit of time on criminal issues, criminal law issues, and courts. I have not done a lot since I left, and so this was a re-entry for me to get into this. But it's a fascinating area, and one that I think, honestly, there's the possibility of cost savings to be achieved with collateral benefits of to both offenders and also to community. One last comment as I say that I want to make sure that we say on record, to the extent that savings are achieved, the only way that this makes sense is if those savings are plowed back into community support and supervision services. If all we're doing is sending people across the street from the prison and nothing more, we're saving beds, but we are not improving public safety, and we are not benefiting their lives. So this is an area where the net savings has to be, you know, we have to be cognizant of that this is not going to create a large pool that you will be able to reinvest in other areas, because in order to make this work, it's got to be a whole. Those services have to be available, or that short-term transitional leave, that those Senate Bill 416 programs are not going to achieve the benefits that they are capable of doing. So that's just a cautionary note, that there's an aspect of commitment to funding the corollary services that go along with the savings by reducing those prison bed populations. So I think I've said my piece. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, thank you, Lane, for doing this. And I just want to reiterate a couple comments that the members who were involved in the work group were the Public Safety Subcommittee co-chairs, Senator Winters and Representative Stark. We still, you know, this is the beginning of discussion. This was not, again, similar to the previous presentations. Not everybody in the group signed off and said, this is how we should do this. What we asked was, if we were trying to meet this target, what was the best way to do that? And then let's take it from there and have further dialogue and discussion. I will remind everyone, when the reduction list for 1719 came out on Monday, in the public safety section, you see a delay in opening new women's beds as one of the cut items on there. And in following up on what Lane said, not only do we want to avoid those costs, we need a plan to do that. We want to continue to maintain the investments we've been making in community corrections and community-based programs through the House Bill 3194 work in justice reinvestment. And if you look at some of the scenarios here, if we do the things even in the minimum scenario, not only do we continue to have better operations at Coffee Creek and don't need new beds, we're not looking at a brand new prison until September of 2025 if we stated those targets. Now, there are a lot of variables. Things can change. But we can keep our community safe and do these things in a way that it does provide more predictability and cost savings in the long term. So I want to say thank you. And this is the beginning. We'll have to figure out where we go next with this. I want to consult with the sub-chairs, see how they want to proceed with this. But this is really helpful. So thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Chair Holden. Mr. Shetterly, neither one of us have changed since we first came to this building.
You've both gotten better looking. Not probably.
oh, wait. I read the reports before I came in here, and one of the things I wonder about, there is some specificity, but did you get a level of detail that would tell you in going to the slightly longer period for transitional leave, 120 days, and the other, which was actually changing the whether or not two sort of lower level property crimes were part of Measure 57. I know that would probably be the bigger factor here. How much both of those might reduce the women's prison population?
Co-Chair, Senator Devlin, those numbers are in Exhibit B. I apologize, there's a lot of squiggly lines there, but if you look at the chart, for instance, on the first page, the short-term transitional leave program, it shows the bed savings, both in terms of female prison bed savings and male prison bed savings. And it does that also then for the minimum and maximum scenarios for Measure 57 changes that we discussed, and each of the components, the Senate Bill 416 and the work release. They're all broken out in terms of women's and men's bed savings.
Okay. In a separate attachment.
Yeah, it's in Exhibit B to the report.
One of the areas, and maybe get your reaction to this, that I always kind of react a little bit negatively to is the issue about not opening the women's correctional facility is, one, it's something people would prefer not to do. Second, we're trying to save costs that we can't afford. I'm going to underline that. We're trying to save costs we can't afford. And I know that there are some provisions in some of these recommendations that would say you would have some modest increase in community corrections costs. But I find it difficult when legislators and advocates believe that because you want to avoid a cost that you can't afford, that you can take then that cost that you have avoided that you could not afford, and then you can spend that on something else. If you couldn't afford it in the first place, you still can't afford it. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you try to do things differently. The fact that you can save a certain amount of money if you can't afford to pay for it in the first place doesn't mean that once you've avoided that, now that you can spend that same amount of money on something else. I mean, that's just a statement. I mean, because I hear this a lot.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Devlin, let me just respond to that. And we did not get into that granular level, but and this is a good question for both LFO and also for the Criminal Justice Commission. My impression, speaking as a non-expert, having spent 6 weeks in this exercise, what I took away is that while there are costs associated with the community support services that are necessary, if you're going to do these things, there is still a net savings between the cost of incarceration and the cost of those services. It costs less to provide the services in the community than it does to maintain a person in prison. And so there is some net savings there. But I fully appreciate you. That's a conundrum that you are going to have to wrestle with. We only had this little piece, it's a problem.
Senator Girard.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holvey. The question I have, and I'm trying to read between the lines who was for and who was against, because you didn't have unanimity. So the question for me is, I look to the professionals that are delivering the services. So Jason Myers with the sheriffs, Kevin Campbell, and I think it's Tim Colan. What did they support in these recommendations? Because that would make a lot easier for some of us.
Senator Girard, since I know that either they are listening or they will listen to this testimony, I'm going to be very careful in how I answer that question. But I will try and speak to address your question and tell you what I understood their objections to be, their concerns. Yeah. Because you guessed it, they were the ones that were not unanimously supportive of these recommendations. And I address it. We address part of it in the report, and it goes back to the House Bill 3194 agreement. the letter that Governor Kitzhaber issued at the end of the negotiations, or in the negotiations of Senate Bill 3194 in 2013. And I addressed that at some length in the report because that was a substantial part of their objection, that basically they had an agreement 5 years ago that we would not revisit sentencing changes anymore for 5 years, and this is only 4 years. And so, you know, it's not on the table to be talking about sentencing reforms. And I respect that. The letter says what it says. The response to that, at least in terms of the majority of the committee, and I've addressed that also in the report, was that we're not entirely confident that the expectations of the letter have been satisfied. We are 4 years into a five-year period. These changes wouldn't implement until 2018, which is 5 years. Senator Winters reminded us a couple of times that this agreement between the governor and the associations on Senate on House Bill 3194 did not involve the Senate. So we were very respectful of that, but we didn't see that letter and that agreement as being a bar to considering sentencing reform for a number of those reasons. I think they felt differently about that, that it was a more significant factor in terms of how appropriate this conversation was. And I will tell you a couple of others. I mean, these are great guys, and they were not hesitant to speak their minds, and one that they addressed in terms of short-term transitional leave was that they felt that better to modify sentences up front than to change than to deal with sentences at the back end. That they thought that for truth in sentencing, that it made it problematic for them to explain that somebody's been sentenced for 3 years, but they're going to get out in 1.5. That is a perspective. In looking at the numbers and what we saw evolving from the rollout of short-term transitional leave, we still believe, I think, as a majority of the committee, that while respecting that position, we're getting great results from short-term transitional leave that are improving public safety and improving the lives of offenders, and that's, I think, for most of the committee, trumped the notion of truth in sentencing as a principle. If you can get better results by doing this, then it makes sense to do it. Those are a couple of the issues, and I think I probably shouldn't say any more than that in terms of speaking for them. But I know that you'll hear those concerns, and they're honest concerns. They're honestly held, and I don't dismiss them lightly. But they are debating points.
Questions, comments? I just one, given that Senator Devlin doesn't seem like he's going to be supportive of plowing all of the cost savings back into programs. I'm curious, you know, in listening to your presentation, it sounded like, you know, focusing on women, for example, it would make sense to, if you were able to spend some of those savings, would they be best spent in trying to treat addictions, for example, for some of the underlying roots involved with some property crimes and those sorts of things, or programs that try to address the needs of children, you know, when their mothers have gone to prison, those sorts of things? I mean, where would you first focus?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator, Representative Holvey, that's a really good question, and one that I am really not in a position to answer because of my own lack of expertise. Having said that, my impression certainly is that what makes short-term transitional leave and the Senate Bill 416 programs work is the commitment and ability of local, on the 416 program especially, to use risk-based assessment to determine who is best suited and who will benefit from these programs. And once they're in, it's housing, it is intense supervision, that deals with drug addiction in many cases, and certainly has to address the family situations. I don't know that I could say that one of those areas is more important than the other, because I think they're all part of the puzzle. I think there are those certainly who are way more experienced in these programs than I am who could probably help you prioritize those, but I don't want to go out on that limb other than that they're all there.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Speaker Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just the final comment. We will certainly figure out the next course of action here in providing a public venue to continue the discussion as presented in the report, and I look forward to that. I will reiterate again that our ability to continue to fund justice reinvestment, even at current service level, and some of the things we are doing now in our public safety budgets, really is predicated at this point, is from how I read how the Public Safety Subcommittee is putting this together, of avoiding opening up OSP for new women's beds. And I would say Coffee Creek is, we are way beyond capacity with emergency beds. We are not operating at smart functioning in terms of overtime. And I mean, there's just, we got to fix that situation. And while we might not be able to put a lot more right into justice reinvestment this next biennium, we'll certainly maintain what we're doing if we're able to do the recommendations that are in this report. So I hope people take this seriously, no matter how hard it might be politically from some perspective. It does seem that it is consistent with what we did in 2013, and we need to continue to do that work if we're going to manage the costs in this system.
Thank you.
Thank you.
President Courtney, would you like a last word?
I'm fine.
Thank you. Well, not seeing any other comments, I appreciate your presentation.
Thank you very
much. Certainly the work of your work group. Thank you very much for all the participants in that. So with that, I have no other business, and we'll adjourn the Subcommittee on Capital Construction of Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, colleagues. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, colleagues. Mm-hmm.